I'm joined by James Denslow, Security and Middle East Analyst at King's College London. James, we've had these confusing statements from the Free Syrian Army. First of all, one commander saying, giving the Assad regime a deadline of tomorrow to end the violence, and then a sort of clarification from the head of the Free Syrian Army saying, no, we're actually looking for Annan to declare that the ceasefire over. What do you make of these two statements?
Well, I think it highlights how fractured and disorganized the Free Syria Army really is, and it reminds me somewhat of the National Transitional Council in Libya that issuing different statements about capturing Saad Gaddafi. Clearly, the issue of the ceasefire, which is only a ceasefire in name and not reality, and the abrogation, the final death of this ceasefire, is a hugely important point for the narrative of what happens next in Syria, and the regime will be very keen to blame the Free Syria Army for the ones to call it off and to go ahead with further violence. But the Annan plan is the only game in town, and it's a game that nobody's playing. And meanwhile, the Free Syria Army have to remember that the legitimacy that underpins their action comes from defending people. And if they're seen to be defending a ceasefire that is not exactly resulting in anything beyond massacres and suicide bombs, then they'll lose legitimacy in themselves. So I think it'll be very interesting to see whether they'll backtrack on the 48-hour deadline and be a bit more flexible and pragmatic. But otherwise, it shows you that the tipping point that Hula massacre created on Friday may be one that's not remembered for further intervention or involvement of outside powers, but rather the thing we look back on as the moment where Syria really did enter a full-blown civil war.
Is the Free Syrian Army in any position to issue Assad with ultimatums?
I think there's no sort of sense that there's a tactical element that something will happen in 48 hours that they've got kind of planning, they've got planned. But I think the Free Syrian Army has to sort of, as I say, look after its own constituency, and it can't be seen to be defending a process where the regime says there's a ceasefire, yet artillery is used on a daily basis and the numbers of dead are kind of oscillating between 40 and 70 a day. So I think they've got to kind of defend their position as a legitimate opposition to the regime. And you could see, once again, this notion of the civil conflict, that if we can all agree that it's a civil war, that the people like the Gulf states might sort of pile in a more sort of practical way to sort of supply the Free Syria Army with weapons, and we could see a vast escalation of the conflict into, a more conventional civil war, and the death tolls will be far greater because you're talking about two sides sort of fire with greater munitions fighting against each other.
Does this intervention make UN action any more or less likely?
The UN has found itself in a very comfortable gridlock where you have the Russians and the Chinese simply protecting any kind of form of real movement in the Security Council. But at the same time, you have the Americans and Europeans who, while very strong on rhetoric and the symbolism of sanctions and expelling diplomats, have no stomach or political capital for any form of real military engagement in Syria. And also, they're unsure whether it could help. So, in a way, the international community and the UN, the main body, is simply not fit for purpose on this conflict. What I'm interested in looking at is how more sort of different elements and different powers can be involved. In particular, I've mentioned the Gulf countries, but also Turkey, a country that's been linked to safe havens, humanitarian corridors, potentially something along the lines of the KRG in northern Iraq being created perhaps along the Turkish border. I think we have to look for far more imaginative solutions now because the traditional elements of statecraft are not defending the Syrian people who are dying on a daily basis, and the responsibility to protect that supposedly is enshrined within recent United Nations sort of direction is not being adhered to.
Explain a bit more about what you mean by imaginative solutions.
Well, I think there are lots of ways to address this. I mean, there's no clear silver bullet theory, although some do think that a defector killing Assad or some of his senior regime figures, that there was the stories of some of his senior leaders being poisoned a couple of weeks ago, could lead to what the Western powers always hoped to happen in Iraq during Saddam Hussein's times. I think there needs to be more kind of ideas like surveillance being used by drone and satellite technology by the Western powers to highlight artillery movements, basically show up the lies that the regime has redeployed when it actually is still using these equipment. I think that there's no simple answer to this. And as I say, things might get a lot worse before they get better. But the Annan plan, although it sort of reduced the violence somewhat and it allowed journalists in and it allowed some prisoners to be released, is not fit for purpose when we're talking about a long-term solution to this. And it could be that Syria is sort of heading towards this sort of crescendo of violence towards civil war and a more fragmented, violent country along the lines of Iraq, a country which, of course, today had over 10 people killed in Baghdad, but it barely makes the news. So I think that's the direction of travel that Syria is going in.
There are reports that American diplomats are privately lobbying Russia for some kind of Yemen-style solution. Do you give those reports credence, and do you think that'll work?
I think this is one of the only games in town, once again, at the diplomatic level. It's why Haig went straight to Moscow after the Hula massacre, is the Russians are providing a diplomatic shield for the Syrians, and they are also arming the regime. So I think if the Russians can be persuaded that it is not in their interest to defend a regime that is taking down the state with it and the state interests that Russia has in that country, including the naval base at Tartus and oil and gas interests, and the fact that the Soviet history with that country meant that I think over three quarters of Syria's infrastructure was built by the Soviets. I think that it has to be explained to them that the West is not looking to do what it did in Libya and push a UN Security Council resolution through on the basis of no-fly zone and then turn that into regime change. Rather, it's simply looking to somehow stop the sort of Assad's regime's violence against its own people. So the Russians may one day be turned, that and the Yemen option could persuade them. But I still believe that even if the Russians were to abandon the regime in Damascus, this is a regime that is simply interested in its own survival and will do anything to kind of ensure that. So even without Russian support, it would simply rely more on the Iranians and sort of regional proxies. But still, it's a big diplomatic hurdle for the Western powers, certainly, to cross, and I think that's one to watch in the near future.
Okay, James, thanks very much.
Thanks a lot.